I wanted to start by reading a piece that I wrote over the summer. It's not in a book yet. It was for an art magazine that I do an occasional column for. And it's a topic that I'm actually writing more about now. I keep gravitating to Arizona. I mean, maybe the sort of nightmare, the Bush regime nightmare, is somewhat past. But in the summer, Arizona really seemed to be the epicenter of it, the black little heart. I think Bush had been out there 36 times when I was there. And so I'll read the Arizona piece first. It's called Greetings from LA. Oh, sorry. If I thump that, you'll hear it. The United States is a prison. It's easy enough to forget this when you're at a party for George Porcari's stunning exhibit of photographs I see for you at Chinatown's Mandarin Gallery. The show was up here during June and July, drawn from two bodies of work made during two decades. The images carry a resolute chill that the hippie-esque title belies. Taken in summer 2005, the more recent work depicts urban landscape in various cities in Europe, reflected against generically modern plate glass windows and doors. The colors are thick, and deep, shifting shadows of architectural foliage fill the transparent void. There's a great deal of visual information in each of these frames, and the photos suggest that it's through a reflective surface that we can best see the disjointed jumble of what's going on. In her catalog essay, the writer Veronica Gonzalez likens the experience of viewing this work to walking around in a strange city. There is no me any longer. I've been shattered and rearranged, decentered and thrown into process, my eye not able to light for more than a few seconds on anything. And yet I send you these greetings, these images proclaim, with my shifting and questioning eye. The earlier series of images, Greetings from LA, dates from 1979. Having arrived with his family from Lima, Peru in the mid-60s, Porcari, as a young man, looks around his new home with disheartened wonder. The mid-rise rectangular offices flanked by low stucco storefronts, the space-age novelty diners, the wide asphalt boulevards, the old men and women in powder blue leisure suits crossing the street like animals lost from their herd. As Gonzalez notes dryly, LA in the 70s was not such an interesting place. But it's through this very lack of visual interest that we sense the estrangement of one who has come from a faraway place and knows he can't return. Such displacement requires one to look sideways and not straight on. Gonzalez, also an immigrant, locates this kind of lateral view as extreme sensitivity. Speaking with George Porcari, who she's known for many years, Gonzalez recalls, "We were sitting at a bar and I'm not sure what we were talking about, sensitivity. Both of our sense of sensitivity, our shyness, and there was a series of bottles lined up in front of us as there are in any bar with a mirror behind them, with a lot of reflections and a lot of light. And you told me that when you were young and you would go to bars with all the other guys after loading trucks, they would all be engaged, drunk, or hooking up, or whatever it is these young guys would be doing. And you would be focused on these bottles, looking at these bottles in the bar because the rest of it was somehow too much for you. So you would find this side element that was still a part of where you were, but was the edges of where you were. And I've thought about that often when we've spoken about edges and fragments in your photography. And somehow that stuck with me, that level of sensitivity in your work." The party took place on another warm Los Angeles evening, and people spilled out the second floor walkway of Mandarin Plaza. There were a large number of people from Europe and Latin America. Tom Watson handed me cigarettes. Luis Baus was back from Mexico City. Denise Bomontour talked about Juan Guistado. Linda Pollack had just returned from the Midwest, where she's preparing a series of public discussions about constitutional rights in the wake of the Patriot Act. It is a strange new phenomenon when artists collaborate with constitutional lawyers, and one that is likely, given the present conditions, to happen more often. After a while, George screened one of his ambient films from the Los Angeles 70s, and everyone went in and sat on the floor. Still, it had been a banner week, June 22nd to 29th, for domestic repression in the U.S., if anyone's still keeping track, and I doubt that they are. Appalled in 2004 by the swift normalization of prisoner torture at Abu Ghraib, the writer Wallace Shawn wrote in Final Edition that trying to keep track of the Bush administration's deliberate lies and suspensions of constitutional law was, quote, like trying to sort scraps of paper in piles in front of a very large fan. But yesterday's outrage becomes today's very old news. Sean's essay was written before the normalization of the Haditha massacres, quote, battle stress and fatigue, New York Sunday Times, and the characterization of the Guantanamo suicides as, quote, acts of asymmetrical warfare, Dick Cheney, 6-1906. Or the docile and neutral report in June 2206 of the Pentagon's decision to suspend all military tribunals and hearings and close the Guantanamo base to journalists and human rights monitors in the wake of the controversy. The day of the Mandarin Gallery party, I had just come back to LA from Arizona. That very week, 600 National Guardsmen had been dispatched by President Bush to augment the work of the Border Patrol in the southern part of the state. That same week, Arizona Republican gubernatorial candidate Don Goldwater described his plan to build forced labor camps for the internment of apprehended illegals to a journalist from the Spanish news agency EFE. Goldwater suggested housing these people in tents behind barbed wire fences and putting them out to work, building a wall between Mexico and the US, a wall that would span 2,000 miles. Build that wall, Mr. President, Goldwater stumped, riffing around the immortal pronouncement of Ronald Reagan, Mr. President, build that, take down that wall, during his visit to the former East Germany. The EFE reporter described this imagined facility as a concentration camp, and a media controversy over the use of the word concentration camp then ensued. This grappling with semantic slippage between concentration and internment, not unlike the abuse versus torture linguistic debate that took place in the wake of Abu Ghraib, soon conveniently replaced the original story. After being predictably censured by more moderate Arizona Republicans, Goldwater played his trump card. This forced labor camp notion was nothing new. In fact, it was, quote, tried and tested, effective and accepted in Phoenix, Arizona by the lunatic ultra-right-wing cowboy Sheriff Joe Arpaio at his Maricopa County Jail, a facility I was soon to learn more of. Meanwhile, the Spanish press agency issued a formal apology for their use of the word concentration. Supervised work was probably more like it. 6 days before, on June 22nd, I'd been relaxing on a Baja, Mexico beach with my friend Eileen Miles when I got a call that my boyfriend had been arrested in Clifton, Arizona, en route to LA. He was being held without bail for extradition to Maricopa County on a 10-year-old warrant he'd been told was, quote, inactive. He phoned from the Clifton County Correctional Facility. Phoenix, the nearest airport, was 4 hours away. Eileen and I threw some clothes in a bag, jumped in her truck, and drove through the night. I remember the red desert of Mexico, driving north of on the two-lane national highway to Mexicali. I remember the strange shapes of organ pipe cactuses and feeling the night close like the lid of a very large box as the sun slowly went down. Driving on Highway 3 is a collaborative art, with drivers signaling each other when to pass, speed up, and slow down. 30 miles south of Mexicali, we stopped at a roadside cafe where everyone sat out together at picnic tables in the diesely light. By 4 a.m., we were in Phoenix, where the landscape was fast food chain stores and pavement. We crashed at a scummy West Phoenix hotel, $105, turned on the broken AC, killed a few roaches. And then Eileen flew home the next day, and I drove on to Clifton, a strange dying town in the easternmost part of the state, whose last civic hope was the county correctional facility, built with federal funds in 1978. The jail was to Clifton what Target is to a derelict mall, a commercial anchor expected to draw visitors, money, and jobs. I checked into the Road Inn Motel, built around the same year as the jail, and tried to be a good tourist, but there was little to buy. The town's only cafe, dehydrated eggs, frozen potatoes, closed at 2. My boyfriend and I were allowed to visit twice a day during the weekend through a plexiglass screen, speaking through faulty handsets, which were nevertheless, as everyone knows, recorded and monitored. The jailers in Clifton were pretty nice, in a smug, revenge of the dumb kids in high school kind of way. In between visits, I drove 40 miles out to Safford and tried to order a salad at the town's only good restaurant. It was 115 degrees, and I wanted to sit in the shade outside on the patio, but the hostess and waitress had a hard time with this, because the patio door was locked, and that the idea that they could unlock the door was an alien notion, as if someone could just do what she wants. "I just work here," the waitress explained, when I asked her what it would take to unlock the door. I noticed her noting the out-of-state plates on my truck. Finally, the owner came over to elaborate. The patio was locked so the waitress could serve other customers, and no, she couldn't unlock the door and let me bring the salad outside and return the plate. Her plump face was channeling meanness through a jubilant smile. Two sheriff's patrol cars were parked right outside, and the owner remarked on how she'd seen me enjoying a drink from the bar last night on her patio. So it seemed best to leave, and I did. That same day, June 24th, the Arizona Republic reported the arrest of seven Haitian men in Miami by Homeland Security. According to FBI Deputy Director John Pistole, their plot was more aspirational than operational. The raid signified his department's commitment to nipping homegrown terror plots in the bud. The men's families were bereft and bewildered. They claim the men met twice a week in a warehouse for religious and martial arts studies, discussing their readings of the Bible and the Quran. Pistole noted a list of shoe sizes as a key piece of evidence from which the men planned to purchase military boots. In Safford, I lost my blue notebook. The arrest of the seven Haitians seemed vaguely familiar, and I recalled a similar roundup of Muslim construction workers and shopkeepers last spring in Chicago, and another in upstate New York. And what's become of those suspects? Nobody knows. A slow, symbolic feed of menace security, depending on which side of the fence you are sitting, enacted on those alien enough not to matter completely. On June 25th, President Bush censored the New York Times for aiding the terrorists by disclosing Homeland Security's routine monitoring of virtually all international banking activity. And my friend was woken and shackled in Clifton at 2:30 a.m., and driven to Maricopa by the same friendly guards who'd hinted at its release the day before. After arriving at Maricopa County Jail, he was issued a regulation black and white striped prison uniform and the supposedly humiliating pink socks and boxer shorts devised by Sheriff Joe. It's important to note that the black and white stripes here are horizontal, as in old Keystone Cops movie, rather than vertical, as in, here goes that word again, concentration camp uniforms. Arpaio is famous for saving the county $4 million a year by cutting down prisoner rations to two meals of green bologna a day, although the county's already spent twice that amount defending human rights lawsuits. 7,453 prisoners are housed in a jail built for 5,000, spilling out of the structure into a makeshift tent city where temperatures reach 138 degrees at the heat of the day. Arpaio has reintroduced chain gangs, where prisoners shackled together dig paupers' graves for the county. One inmate's family received $8.5 million in damages when he died in a restraining chair, a device used in Abu Ghraib, while being held for a driving infraction. "This call is recorded and monitored," a robot voice said while asking me to press 5 to accept collect charges from an inmate. And it struck me that the voice was no different than the voices I hear when calling Citibank, MasterCard, and Verizon, except they've left out the words for quality assurance and the tone's a bit sterner. And I realize we've been in training for this now for quite some time. The point has been lost, or we no longer expect there to be any point. We no longer ask why the routine calls should be recorded and monitored, or why any of the customer service associates we speak with for hours a day are forbidden to speak off a script, or why there is so little difference between a human voice and a robot's. We no longer notice that every new act of repression reported gets lost in the wake of procedural debate that claims 5 times more media space than the event that provoked it. Torture, abuse, forced labor, supervised work. Once we consent to be addressed via script, we no longer expect words to have any particular meaning. Quality, terror, security. Driving home on Interstate 10 after my friend was released, billboards announced "God Bless America, report all suspicious activity to Homeland Security." And there were Border Patrol trucks swarming everywhere, just like animal control, except instead of a row of cages, they have one tiny door. And I watched them flush a terrified man out from behind desert rocks. Thank you.